Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, ethics and the agency dilemma. I'll probably have to finish the topic on Wednesday. And also, of course, today, you will have a quiz, your seventh quiz of the eight that are coming. So let me get to the story of the day. Before that, let me do some look at the numbers. This was a grouchy day on the street. It was just a bear market, but it was also bear all over the world. If you look over here and just a quick look at the Nikkei, interestingly, if you look right here at the Nikkei average, you'll see on the spark chart that it was plunging just before noon. And I saw this starting to happen late last night. Remember, they're running when we're asleep. It's daytime there. And the Nikkei started a recovery from its dive, and it actually almost made it back to where it started for the day. And it was down only 0.1%, which is pretty much negligible. So it was recovering. Now, the Hang Seng actually started recovering too, a little later than Tokyo did, but it was climbing. It didn't make it even near where it started the day, but it was down for the day about 0.75%. Europe was sort of about the same story, although it tried to do a recovery in the early afternoon, but it fizzled out by the end of the day, as you can see in that spark chart right there. Now, the FTSE did the same thing. It plunged, and then it tried to climb back up, but then there was a sell-off right before the closing over in London, which happened an hour or two ago. Coming over here to the United States, you can see that all of our markets were in a really bad mood. The Dow just plowed down. By the end, it had stabilized, but it was down more than 1% for the day. The S&P 500 was down almost 1%. And then the NASDAQ, it actually was doing a little better. Interestingly enough, this was an odd day. The Dow lost the most, the S&P lost less, and then the NASDAQ was the least of the losers for the day. But nevertheless, it was definitely a bear market on the street. Now, coming down here, looking, gold has just kind of made its mind up that it's going to float a little above $4,000 an ounce for the time being. It's probably going to make a run upward later in this month, possibly next month. But it is definitely higher than it has been for a long time. Now, crude oil is still way down, as you can see, below $60 a barrel, and it's going to stay there for a long time to come. But within a year, that will change dramatically, and it will turn around and start climbing once it has wiped out all of the small production entities that can't afford to pull oil out of the ground at that price. Look here at the sectors. Notice even the technology sector was down. This was definitely overall a bear day. There were only a very few sectors that had green anywhere in them. So it was definitely one of those days that we see that the markets are in a grouchy mood. It's not anything like a black swan, but we do want to keep an eye on it, because there are more and more trading policies that are bearish right now, beginning to look a little more toward the longer term and the very bad situation we see coming up on the horizon. But that's not really dominating the traders now. They're still doing trades day by day, minute by minute. But there's beginning to get to be an uneasy feeling up there on the street. I wanted to show you something. I have tried to introduce you to different sectors during this semester, the retail sector, the defense sector, the biomedical sector. And as we're coming to the close, I just wanted to give you an exposure just to a few more sectors. Now, the one that I'm going to focus on today is transportation. And transportation is a broad term. But first, I'm going to look at some that are recognizable to you. FedEx, FDX, is one that you're familiar with. It's transportation, delivery, moving goods from one place to another. And if you look there, FedEx is down for the day, but it's beginning a nice little recovery. The thing to look at here is, what kinds of betas do we see? What kind of overvaluation, undervaluation? So what we would look at here in this beta is 1.34 FedEx. That is noticeably risky. That's right there about on the borderline of where a normal investor would want to place his or her risk bets. If you look, its PE ratio, though, is saying that it's somewhat undervalued. So you're looking at a stock that's risky, but there is a chance for some upward movement more toward its an intrinsic valuation PE ratio. What I want to do real quick here is just remind you one more time, look at the capital gains picture for these stocks. The holding period returns for these stocks. Now, in this case, we're looking at a projection for FedEx that in 1 year it would be $271.36. Whoops. Divide that by, okay, we're going to buy it today and hold it for a year, 264 today. 73. Okay, then do the minus 1 equals, and then times it by 100. Now, the capital gain on this stock for a 1 year holding period return would be a lousy 2.50%. Okay, let's add in the dividend, which is 2.17% plus 2.17%. The total holding period return for a 1 year investment on FedEx is a lousy 4.67% on a stock with a beta well above 1. This is not a good investment. This is one that you want to avoid. One of the things that I've wanted to get you aware of is that you have the ability to take fairly basic numbers off a public platform and make some at least rough decisions about what is a good investment and what is a bad investment. In a case like FedEx, I don't see this as being worth even looking at again, unless something dramatic happens, and FedEx is not a company that's full of drama, even though it's risky. Now, another one that I would want to bring your attention to, just on the same vein of those delivery companies, UPS. Now, UPS is a company that is not as risky, but it's still riskier than the market portfolio. Okay, we can live with that. And it does pay a dividend, and its dividend is actually pretty handsome. Look at that dividend yields. What is that? 6.83%. PE ratio is indicating that it's undervalued. Okay. Let's see what, let's do a projection of holding period return on this one. So if we bought it today, in 1 year we sell it at a projected price of $103.62. Divided by what we paid for it today, $94.19. Whoops. $94.19 minus 1. Equals Okay, 10% times 100 equals. Okay, let's add in that nice dividend yield plus 6.83%. And actually, that's not a bad investment. 16.84% total 1 year holding period return. You buy it today, you dump it in a year. You've got the capital gain on the stock. You've got a nice fat dividend check, and it's got a beta just a little above the market, about 1.10. So yeah, it is a little riskier, but that's a darn decent return for 1 year hold. Sure beats sticking your money in a bank account. So there you go. Now, let me take you over to another sector, a subsector. I'm going to have a look at Union Pacific. And you'll notice something right off the bat with Union Pacific. Now, are any of you familiar with what Union Pacific does? It's rail, rail transportation. The big old heavy iron engines, the big diesels pulling them across the country from the docks and through the prairie lands to the coast again. Let's have a look at it. First thing, beta, flat 1.00%. In other words, it is just in a well-diversified portfolio, this behaves just like the market itself does. PE ratio, it's undervalued, pays a dividend. So let's have a look at this stock, see what we get out of it. So in a year, we would, if we bought it today, in a year, that's 260, 42, divided by, we buy it today for 221.00, minus 1. Whoa. Okay. Now we add, times 100. Times 100. So just the stock price going up gives you a yield for 1 year hold of 17.84%. Now we add in that nice little dividend. It's not spectacular, but it's decent, 2.48%. So this stock's got a 20.32% projected return for holding it for 1 year. That doesn't suck at all. I mean, that's a lot better than UPS or FedEx, because even with UPS, you don't get that return and you've got a higher beta. So you see how these numbers show us which investments dominate which other investments. And in this case, if I were looking at these, I would probably say that Union Pacific, if I want to have something in the transportation sector, which is a good idea in a well-diversified portfolio, you want to try to sample from as many sectors as you can. This isn't bad at all. This looks like a decent investment. I'm curious, and I should know better than to do this. I'm going to do one more, train. CSX, it's got a lot of different arms, but now as you can see, CSX is actually an affordable stock here, but it does have a nasty beta of 1.30, and it is a little undervalued. Let's see if it's worth our time. Projection is that it will pull my God, my eyes are so bad, 39.20. 39.29 divided by 34.01 minus 1 equals times 100. Oh, that's decent. So it's got on the core increase in stock value, capital gain. That's 15.52%. Okay, now add into that 1.48 or 1.49% dividend yield, and you get a total holding period return of 17.01%. That's not shabby, But if you look at CSX versus Union Pacific, you'll see that you're getting a higher return, expected return, with Union Pacific for a lower risk. So you can see that even though this is paying a pretty decent holding period return, 1 year holding period return, it is still dominated by Union Pacific, which gives a better return for a lower beta. And this is more or less objective analysis. You're doing just the numbers telling us which is the better investment or the best of a group of investments we're looking at. That truth be told, Union Pacific is surprisingly strong. And the beta is not excessive because it's rail, and rail is always going to be with us, moving stuff from one place to another across the country. And so, in a way, investing in rail stocks gives you a history. They have been around for a long, long time, almost 150, 200 years. So definitely, we probably want to talk about these more seriously as good, solid, long-term investments in a well-diversified portfolio, of course. Enough of that. Let me check something here real quick. I want to do the subject of ethics now for a while. Now, one thing to point out is a part of this lecture on ethics is the agency dilemma. And I do have a PowerPoint presentation for that part of this lecture. Files, if you go into your files, you should see agency on the top level of your files. It's a PowerPoint presentation which basically recaps the part of my ethics lecture that has to do with agency. And I'll probably do the agency dilemma on Wednesday because I need to give you plenty of time for your quiz. But to begin this, we talk about ethics. Now, I am supposed to teach you about ethics. It's part of a suggested or strongly suggested requirement, both for accreditation and for to comply with the State's Department of Education. They require that I show you, talk to you about ethics. Every year, I must take an ethics training course to make sure that I am totally ethical. Now, this, of course, is in the state of Illinois, which is historically known to be the most ethical state in the Union. Lol. Illinois has historically been one of the most corrupt states in the nation. Ethics is sort of something that they want everyone else to practice while they proceed from one decade to the next for a century, more than a century, for two centuries otherwise. Here's the thing, though, is that the problem with the ethics training that I take and that I'm supposed to be talking to you about is to know the ethics laws in the state. The misunderstanding, deliberate possibly, that if you comply with the law, then you are ethical. That's ethics, which is in fact false. It's the law is a pale animal. In fact, that is dangerous to think that way, because in common law, in civil law, you can comply with every regulation to the letter and still be exposed to liability for torts that you commit. Well, we complied with all the regulations and all the specifications for making these baby seats. So we cannot be sued when children are killed in auto crashes wearing these. Oh, yes, you can. A compliance with the regulation does not indemnify you from liability for the consequences of your actions. Now, this is becoming a bigger thing in corporate America. We even have the term corporate governance, which is blossoming everywhere now because it is an important part of the new corporate landscape, the landscape of the 21st century. Now, this is even more a huge thing in Europe and in other parts of the world. Corporate governance that does not allow for unethical action. Now, a word about ethics. It is a secular word. It is related somewhat to a more religious term, moral. Ethical action may not be moral, but oftentimes we think of morality and ethical action as being one and the same. They are not, and I don't probe into morality at all in this. It's all focused on ethical action. Think of it as rightful action. Now, I start with a little grid here, a 4x4 grid. Now, on the top, I will have legal and illegal. And then I will have on the side ethical and unethical behaviors. Any one of these can be in play in personal life, but more importantly for us, in corporate life. You can have actions and decisions that are legal and ethical. This is what the law says, and it is also what is right to do. That's what we ideally like to think is going to happen. It does not necessarily happen. You also have actions that are patently illegal, but they are ethical, rightful actions. They happen quite often. In corporations, we have whistleblowers who are going to say, okay, what they did may have been legal, but it hurt people. It hurt customers. It hurt some constituency in one way or another. In government, this becomes a particularly large issue. And the number of places where I can tell you about illegal actions that were ethical is almost innumerable. I'll give you an example. This happened some years back. There was a Department of Defense employee. She had a very odd name. Her name was Reality Winner, of all things. But she was working on handling these files that had to do with videos that were being taken in the Iraq war zone. And she came across one that showed a group walking along. There were two armed men, and then there was a group of civilians between them, and they were walking along, some children. And this, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they were all fragged. That means that they were all killed by American snipers. They were just all shot dead. Now, this was a top secret video. The explanation was, well, they off terrorists. This was a group of terrorists, and they had hostages. It was clear, and it was clear afterwards, that these were guards that were walking civilians through dangerous zones, and yet they were all killed. She released the video, and she was prosecuted and sent to prison for many years, but her action explained to the people, the survivors, the family and survivors of those killed, they weren't doing anything wrong. So what was done to them was downright evil. That was an illegal action. She went to prison for it, but she did what she considered to be rightful behavior. And there's a problem is that when we talk about ethics, sometimes it can go bleed into subjective decisions. I think this is wrong, and I know that if I do something about it, I will go to prison. Whistleblowers oftentimes in corporate America face the same dilemma. They will release private email messages. They will release private financial information. And that's illegal. And yet, what they did was beneficial and rightful. Now, legal but unethical is a very common problem. We comply with the law even though what we're doing is suspect or just not right. We have no law that keeps us from raising the prices of these drugs that keep people alive. There's no law that says we can't do it. And yet, it is unethical because people literally will die because they can't afford their medicines. Great example, a few months ago, the young man, he could not afford the skyrocketed price of insulin. And so he was just basically watering it down, and ultimately he died. The same thing happened to my mother many years ago. I didn't know she was just injecting water into her little insulin bottles until it was too late. Unethical action, legal to jack up the price of the medicine, but is it right? Now there's a problem, is that it's subjective. I say, hell no, that's wrong. That's wrong, that's not ethical, that's unethical. However, someone else might say, hey, that's a free market, live with it, fat boy. Okay, and now there are also, of course, illegal and unethical actions. Great example, current news, Jeffrey Epstein. He trafficked in minors, which is illegal, and trafficking in minors is also unethical as hell. So there's your framework where you can land in any decision that you make or any situation you face, both personally and in the corporate world, that is in any one of those slots. Let me take you a little backwards here. When we came out of the Middle Ages, we were beginning to break free of the absolute dominance, the categorical dominance of religious behavior. That was the guidance for all life. Up until the end of the Middle Ages, we came into the Renaissance, beginning to break away from that. We were looking for a secular explanation for the universe, a secular way to proceed in our societies and in our governance. It was a long haul process. In fact, one of the stories that I can I recall from my days in this subject was that things like witch trials, which had been going crazy in the 1415 and 1600s, finally, by the time we get to about the middle 1600s to the late 1600s, you were beginning to get this sense that, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. These people shouldn't be killed and horribly mutilated and all this and tortured. Witches don't exist. Come on, stop being so superstitious. And so it began to soak away. We were moving toward a secular, rational way to proceed. And this is what was coming about in the thought about ethics and morality as well. We have several philosophers who were trying to find a basis for ethical action that was not based, that was not inherited from a religious book. And some of those, there were a number of them, but one that comes stands out somewhat was Immanuel Kant. And all you have to remember is Kant. I don't even know if I'm spelling that first name right. But Kant, he came up with the categorical imperative. Now, this is categorical. In other words, anything can be put into this. Anything. This is a strict guide. And it's an imperative, meaning you will do this. And it works something like this. This is an English translation of German, which tends to be a more complex, subtle language, but this is the best I can do, is always act as you would expect others to act. Always act as you would expect others to act. Now you say, well, that's just a golden rule. No, it's not. The golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This isn't about you as the victim or something like that. This is for you when you see what other people do. That's irrelevant. It is really irrelevant. You act as you would expect them to behave, always. And that is this no exceptions policy. Well, I'm going to do it this way because, no, is that what you want others to do? If it isn't, then you better not do that. Do not act that way. Now, if everyone were to follow the categorical imperative, the society would function quite well, at least theoretically. And I say theoretically because we can't have this. Because people don't always act as they expect others to act. You know as well as I do that people are hypocritical. Corporations are hypocritical. They will not always act as they expect others to act. I don't want you to act, my customer, as I will act. I expect you to be better than I am. When you have a bank like one from some years ago that was cheating hundreds of thousands of customers out of interest of being charged, well, they would have pissed themselves raw if their customers had overcharged them for something. But see, there's the problem, is that we can't have the categorical imperative be our guidance because everyone violates it. Well, I certainly don't expect you to have that medical procedure. Well, you don't understand. I had to have that done because of the circumstance I was in. Hypocrisy kind of wrecks the categorical imperative. Let me take you around now to the 19th century. But I should point out that the 18th century, this was coming along too. Because we see in democratic institutions, like the U.S. system, we see this even in the 1700s. It was percolating through the 1700s. But we got a very formal handle on it a little later. What we call situational ethics. And as the name implies, it is not categorical. Your behavior is within the situation. Now there are, I'm going to break this up, and this is kind of a real loose way of doing it, into a strict version of situational ethics and a loose or non-strict version. The strict version is extraordinarily popular, and it is the basis of democracies. We can frame it, one of the leading luminaries of this was a man named John Stuart Mill, M-I-L-L. He was known for his writings in education and philosophy, and he brought forth utilitarianism. Utilitarianism works like this. Your action should be for the greatest good for the greatest number. The greatest good for the greatest number. That's utilitarianism in a nutshell. You can see this is how democracies work. But it's not how corporations work. It's certainly not. Corporations work the greatest good for the shareholders, period. This whole thing about, well, we got all these stakeholders and we got to take them all into account. No, the shareholders, maximization of their wealth is all that matters. So corporate behavior is not utilitarian. However, in general, utilitarianism is very popular. Do the greatest good for the greatest number. It is also downright evil in the sense that it allows for discrimination. Well, these minorities, they're not the greatest number. So what we do is going to act for the dominant race or the dominant ethnic group. That's utilitarianism. Well, you know, these people, they're not only a minority of the population. because of their sexual orientation, their religion, whatever. It is okay to discriminate against them because we are doing the greatest good for the greatest number. And so utilitarianism has that gaping hole in it that allows us to commit acts against minorities, and that's all there is to it. In the corporate world, utilitarianism certainly is not in play because the shareholders of a single corporation are certainly not the greatest number of people in the country or in the world. In fact, the power in a corporation's governance is determined by a very small set of shareholders who own vast numbers of shares. And more, the shares are being held by other corporations in an interlocking environment. Right now, the best estimate is that 75% of all corporate ownership is by other corporations. So we are the minority. So it doesn't even fall into this ethical framework. Now, situational ethics is problematic because it is loose. Each situation has its own ethical direction that should be proceeded. You can't say the greatest good for the greatest number, this will be fine, don't worry about it. So there's a problem with that one right there, that looseness. Let me give you an example. Okay, here we go. You, madam, are the CEO of Mega Pharma Big Time International. You create medicines that help people. You got to do something, you know. But your company has been working on a cure for a childhood disease. It doesn't hit many kids. In other words, you are researching an orphan drug, trying to develop an orphan drug. That's a drug that is rather costly because you're not going to save a lot of people with it, but otherwise there are some people who will die. The drug that you're working on cures a disease that if a child has it, the child will die in about 2 years. Very tight distribution. You have developed a drug and you are about to announce it at a public meeting, public press conference tomorrow. This drug cures the disease. It will allow the kids to live complete, full, long lives. Now, the night before, you're in your office, you're fiddling with your papers, you want to get out of there, get some dinner, and then get refreshed for this great news conference. Because when you announce this, that the clinical trials are over and the drug is incredible, the stock price will go through the roof. You will be fulfilling your one and only one obligation, is to maximize shareholders' wealth. And I come in, I'm the chief scientist researcher on the drug. And I close the door and I say, here's the problem. And it does indeed cure the disease. In 999 of 1,000 kids, it cures it. They live complete lives. But one child in the 1,000 dies within 6 weeks of taking the drug. He dies. He could have lived 2 years. But he will die in 6 weeks. Now, what are you going to do at that conference? When you do that press conference, are you going to announce, we're going ahead with the drug, everything is great, it's all done, and watch stock price go up, the shareholders think you're the hero goddess of the universe? Or do you say, we are not going to distribute this drug without significant further tests to make sure it does not have any lethality rate? Which are you going to do? I know, right? I asked this in the last class, and there was some little guy, he said, which kid is going to die? And then I thought, no, wait a minute, let me think about that. Is it that ugly ass kid that, no. What are you going to do in this kind of a situation? What would you do? Remember, when those shareholders are going to vote you a huge pay increase, and the stock price is going to go through the roof. And if you cut the drug, well, basically, they're going to turn your ass into grass. What are you going to do?
I probably want to push it back a bit, but...
Well, that's the end of it for you. We don't need you anymore. You're out of the C-suite. Take away your key to the executive's washroom. You can do it that way, okay?
What if one of the 1 out of 1,000 kids is a shareholder's kid?
There's another thing. What happens if it's your kid? Exactly. There's the problem, is that that one, the greatest good for the greatest number, it falls apart in this ethical dilemma. Hopefully you will never face anything quite that bad, but some of you are going to work for corporations that every day do things that you will get praised for by a lot of people, but you know that what you're doing is horrifically wrong. Because of the machinery that is being used, it is machinery of war being applied to civilians by the tens of thousands. How do you handle those? The greatest good for the greatest number, well, the occupying state is the greatest number. And so it's no problem to you. You make the sales to them. You get huge sales revenue on your income statement. But how do you live with yourself when you see, if you try, you may not want to see it, but you might see it, leveling of entire cities that were as far out as the landscape as you could see to the horizon, and they are rubble on the ground with many bodies, mostly children, in that rubble. What do you do? There's the problem. We have to see some ethical direction here. Do we stick with this utilitarianism and just say, no, I don't want to talk about it? Or do we go to a loose situational ethic where we use utilitarianism when it is functionally useful, but then we allow ourselves the possibility that in some situations, the greatest good for the greatest number is not the way to proceed? And I will finish this by talking about the agency dilemma in the next lecture. For now, I'm going to have you open your attendance radar and get your attendance, and then you take the quiz, and then I'm done with you for the day.